On today's episode of Books and Beer, we talk about Elif Batuman's book, The Possessed, about her adventures with Russian literature. We both like the book, and we try to explain why you should read this book about Russian literature, even if you don't like Russian literature. So check it out. Hi, welcome to episode 4 of Books and Beer. I'm Greg.
I'm Clarissa.
And we're here today to talk about the book, The Possessed, by Elif Batuman.
And it's subtitled Adventures with Russian Books and the People Who Read Them.
So it's a real fun little memoir, sort of, but not like memoir in the case you think of it. It's more sort of along the lines of sort of a comedy, just detailing all the adventures she has in terms of going up through Russian literature in grad school.
It kind of reminded me of maybe like an Errol Morris documentary on the page. It in the sense that everyone is just sort of presented as they are, and some of these people are very well crafted and interesting characters on the page, and it's not, she's not so much telling you about herself as she has this whole experience of graduate school with Russian literature, and very entertaining, some of the chapters.
Yeah, and it's sort of, I mean, and when you're talking about Errol Morris, you're talking about his earlier documentaries, like Burn in Florida.
Not so much Fog of War.
But also, I guess the other reference point would be like a Christopher Guest documentary.
Yeah, it's like showing people in their natural environment and the way they behave and interact with each other, and sort of putting that out there and letting you draw whatever conclusions you want to from it.
Yeah, and so the structure of it is actually, it's based around sort of a set of essays, because that's what it originally was published as. Just sort of piecemeal over the years. The first piece is Babel in California, which is about a conference for the writer Isaac Babel. And that was published in N plus one back in 2005 or so.
And then, I didn't know that.
That was her big break. And then after that, she got picked up by the New Yorker for a profile. And then at that point, the offer started flying around, and she really got into it. So that's actually how it got started. And then at a certain point, she got enough material and finished her PhD actually in Russian literature, that she decided to go ahead and structure a whole book around it. And so it talks about some conferences she went to, but there's also a piece that sort of is interwoven throughout about how she managed to spend a summer in Uzbekistan.
To study the Uzbekistan national language and literature.
Even though she's a Russian literature major, and just a bunch of like comic mishaps that got her into that situation, how weird a situation it was. Really interesting about the Uzbek language. And then it finishes up by talking about Dostoevsky's Demons.
Which is a work, I have to admit, I couldn't remember ever hearing of before. And I am not, there's one area in which I am horribly deficient in my reading. It's definitely Russian authors. Aside from some Chekhov short stories, I really haven't read any of the Russians yet. But I thought I was sort of cursorily familiar with Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and their major works. But Demons was not something that I was familiar with.
Yeah, Demons and The Idiot are two of the ones that aren't really discussed so much out of, because everybody knows.
I knew about The Idiot. Well, I recognized the title of The Idiot. I've heard of it before, but I hadn't ever heard of Demons before.
Well, it's called like Demons by some translations, but like literally possessed. So it's sort of a weird little one, but yeah, I'm in the same situation. Sadly enough, I haven't really read much Dostoevsky or Tolstoy, or anything really. not even any of the like contemporary Russians that like New York Review of Books is putting out, although they're on my list of stuff I want to get to.
Which is, of course, not a very short list.
No. I mean, even if it was just a list of the books in here that I haven't read, it's got several years or so that I'm going to have to dig through it. But
well, you gave The Possessed 5 stars on Goodreads, I noticed, is rare praise from Gregory Brown.
Really. I don't know.
Well, it's,
well, I mean, for books that we've done in the podcast, I guess.
But, no. I mean, you are usually pretty heavy-handed with your criticisms.
Well, and, yeah.
For you to really enjoy a book means that it was something special, I think.
Oh, and shucks.
So I guess I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about, you know, what you enjoyed so much about it.
Well, first was that it's a premise that sort of, there's a lot of landmines there as far as anytime a writer is really writing about writing or writing about reading, it's sort of, you're very close to becoming this horrible ego-sucking sort of circular work. Especially if it's more so, I think, in fiction. Because in fiction, it's sort of a sort of roundabout way of writing what you know, and sort of emphasizes just how not diverse the sort of the MFA ecosystem is, how closed in the MFA ecosystem tends to be.
Wait a minute, you're going from criticizing writers who write about writing all of a sudden to criticizing.
There's like literary criticism, which I'm okay with, and then there's like novels about young writerly types in like Brooklyn or whatever.
Okay, can you name me some of those books that you're speaking of?
Just MFA short stories and stuff.
No, see, you're just being too general there. I don't accept
okay.
that.
Okay. shoot. Like a lot of the stuff in that Jennifer Egan book, Visit from the Goon Squad, has like young 20-somethings and that kind of stuff. That's the thing though, because like we've sort of gotten out of it more recently. You've got more authors who instead of are writing about their own experience, but they're sort of the approach tends to be more that they're dramatizing the outside world and sort of, I was thinking about this the other day, a lot of authors instead of sort of writing, they used to sort of write a generic, you know, living in the city narrative and then make themselves a little wacky or obsessed, but instead nowadays they're almost externalizing that out into the world and making the world sort of oddly obsessed with something, like Gary Sheingart's super sad true love story or whatever. It's sort of this work of I haven't actually, from what I've heard of it, it sounds like really shitty futurism. But it's got this weird obsession with like personal appearance and personal status and that kind of thing, where you might have used to have written a story 5 or 10 years ago. Somebody would have written a story about someone who's obsessed with the personal status in that way. But now there's more of a move to externalize that in the world, which I think is sort of a good development, as compared to something where closer to like American Psycho or something like that, where you sort of posit almost a pretty normal world, but then you throw someone who's pretty
okay
single-minded in it. Another example I think would be Miles Klee's Ivyland, which sort of posits a world that's much more pharmaceutical than the current one, and sort of that kind of stuff I would say is more common amongst sort of later fiction.
Well, isn't Infinite Jest to some extent that way?
Well, it has a little bit of it has wacky characters and sort of a wacky world. Mm-hmm. So I mean, that's sort of Infinite Jest is sort of bursting at all the seams. Uh-huh. it's very maximalist in sort of how it approaches. There's nothing minimalist about the book really. It sort of goes all out in every sense. So, but it does sort of have the weird sort of, I guess the undercurrent to all this is sort of like a weird Pynchonian sort of like almost slapstick universe Slapstick of the Universe, sort of where everything's sort of a bit goofy and exaggerated in a certain way. Sort of, it's not as prevalent in Infinite Jest. It's there, but it's not as prevalent as The Broom of the System, which was DFW's first novel. And then, you know, you hear about it all the time with Pynchon as far as just the wacky little scenes that they get into with, like, molasses factories and that kind of thing. But yeah, that was a weird tangent.
But well, I was trying to think just now how we got there, and I think it was...
Yeah, I think it was sort of discussing the fallacy of writers and then trying to justify that
you,
and so...
But anyway. There, I mean, when you're speaking of, you know, the oddities of the world out there, I mean, this is a nonfiction book, but the oddities are brought into pretty sharp focus.
Yeah, I would say there's a lot of weird characters and a lot of weirdly, like, would not survive outside of academia characters. And there's a big sense throughout the book. I think one of the successes of it is it has a bunch of people in the memoirs that seem almost like characters plucked out of a Russian novel or a Russian story that you wouldn't see really so much in American fiction. They're brash. They're very single-minded. Events will just strike without really any warning in a way that you normally expect to see foreshadow. Or just, there's something functionally different, I think.
It's sort of like the saying that people resemble their dogs and or their pets, and whether or not that's a product of time spent with the animal or if that's something that they're just naturally drawn to in that animal because it resembles themselves. I get the sense from this book that a lot of people who study Russian literature have something of that in them, and whether it comes from spending their whole time around these books and or whether they're drawn to these books because it's already in them, I wouldn't be able to say. But you're right in that there's definitely a sense of them partially belonging to another little world. And it is very Russian. Russianness, I think, is hard to define.
Yeah, it's sort of like a resignation to sort of circumstances, and like life is going to suck in very certain ways, and it's just sort of, that's just the way it is.
And the heaviness too. You hear it in the music too. You can always tell Russian composers. And this, I still believe that, you know, when you listen to Russian composers, the only way to listen to it is by Russian orchestras or Russian musicians. And for some reason, that just, it's hard to describe though. It is, but that comes across in this book too, I think. Russianness and what Russianness is, and I think for the author too, her experiences with the language, and she's Turkish. She's American, but she speaks Turkish. She's first generation Turk, and in the section where she's talking about studying Uzbek, you know, she was trying to find Uzbek spectrum on the Russian-Turkish scale, and she kind of comes to the realization that that's not what it is, and it's not on some sliding scale between Turkish and Russian. It's its own language and its own history and its own place and place of mind and attitude and personality, and
but at the same time it's in some ways sort of almost an artificial culture, because it's been sort of engineered by the Soviet Union in terms of giving it a certain way to spell words, and the way that they've engineered and re-engineered the language over the years to change the alphabets used and all that kind of stuff. So there's this sort of, there's a sense of deep history, like they'll refer back to, you know, the 1400s or so in a way that we couldn't really do in the US so much. But at the same time, there's a big gap where, where Uzbek literature was not really a thing. And even now it's sort of struggling back to life. And so, like, nobody reads Uzbek literature, I think. She was trying to find some Uzbek literature to study, and she couldn't find any in the bookstores.
Yeah, it didn't exist in the bookstores. And
So it's this weird situation where she's sent to study something that doesn't really seem to exist. It's sort of, it's very absurd. It's sort of, Kafka is sort of the... an undercurrent of institutions gone out of control, and the absurdity of that, and you get that very much in some of these stories, especially the Summer and Sarkin one that sort of runs throughout it.
And two, the Tolstoy, there's an essay in a where she's talking about her experience at the International Tolstoy Scholar Scholarship Conference, but it takes place at Tolstoy's old estate, and she gets, her luggage was lost on the flight in, and so she's stuck at this conference in which she's presenting a paper, and she's sort of stranded in what she wore on the plane, which was pajamas to sleep in, and she has to give a presentation dressed in her pajamas, but it's very Tolstoyan to be dressed that way, mm-hmm. and it is sort of an odd, but it's relayed in a way that just sort of accepts the absurdity for what it is, and it's not deliberately, maybe it is deliberately trying to be amusing, but she's a good enough writer that mm-hmm. it doesn't come off as obsequious in that way. It's a very entertaining and I don't know if I'd call it, I feel like if I say it's an easy read, that does it a disservice, but it's not one that takes a whole lot of time to get through.
No, and it's very engaging, and it's interesting in that it's covering a lot of subjects that we would typically think of as academic, but it treats it in a very unacademic, so it's like the opposite of everything that you hate about academic writing.
Mm-hmm.
And she does it all, like she's a really good writer. That was one of the reasons why I was really blown away, is that I didn't realize just how good of a writer she is. And she's very good in that she sort of manages to do things that are very difficult and make them look very easy. And in sort of an effortless way that unless you really look at it, you don't understand all the effort it must have taken, or the skill that it must have taken to get it to come out so elegantly. And then she'll switch from just reporting a situation into literary criticism, especially the last piece about mm-hmm. the possessed,
which is really fantastic. I mean, even as a standalone essay, mm-hmm. it's worth reading.
And but she actually delves into sort of the different ways that people understand Dostoevsky and sort of weighs them, and it's amazing. It's it's up there with one of the better essays that I've read, and it's handled very elegantly.
Yeah, and she's talking about things like mimetic theory, which I had never heard of before. Yeah. it's the kind of thing where if we were here to talk about it and trying to explain it to you, your eyes start to glaze over.
Yeah.
But she does it in such a way that it's makes a lot of sense, and it's brilliantly explained, and it's not terribly complicated to grasp, and mm-hmm. and she's filling that in with information about Dostoevsky, and then this sort of beautiful story from her own group of friends while she was in graduate school mm-hmm. that winds up reflecting a lot of what's in Dostoevsky's book and mimetic theory and engaging with all these things that she presented earlier. And it's done so artfully and so beautifully that it's not... And I'm sure that it was a very difficult essay to write, to put together in such a way that it comes across so, so beautifully. But it really is... It really... The last chapter is fantastic.
Mm-hmm. And it has... And the thing that's great, it has sort of an arc, an overall arc to it, that is done... really incredible. I guess the best sort of comparison I would have is one of my other favorite essays is Authority and American Usage by David Foster Wallace, where he talks about a usage manual, or sort of a fancy dictionary
mm-hmm.
By Brian Garnett, which I actually own the newer edition of because I'm a huge nerd. But and he's sort of he's talking about it, but he's also talking about the way we use language, and he sort of is jumping between all these different levels, and it all sort of comes full circle, and sort of you get somewhere by the end of it, and it's saying things about things, and at the same time it's hugely entertaining and very thoughtful, and it's just firing on all cylinders and functions in such a gorgeous way that you probably couldn't remove any piece of it, and it would be much less for having removed that piece. And I would say that the last essay functions just like that. It's really fantastic. So,
a rousing endorsement indeed. I think the first one you've given on the podcast.
I would say so. Yeah, I have no complaints about the book, and so
if it's really, you know, I was laughing out loud at some points and at others, and I really learned a lot about things that I had no knowledge of, like Uzbek national history. Yeah. And none of it was boring, none of it was dull, much of it was very, very funny. And it really, I think it's a unique book. It paints a picture of a unique sort of mm-hmm. place and person and group of people. And
yeah, it's a book that got a lot of praise whenever it came out.
Which is funny to me, because I don't recall ever hearing about it before. You picked it up in the bookstore, and I recognized her name as Turkish, but I thought she was a different Turkish writer.
But, yeah, it got a lot of talk around, like, the Millions and other book blogs and that sort of group. And I guess I was exposed to a bit more of it, because I really keep up with the N+1 stuff. And their Twitter feed and all that kind of junk. It got nominated for a National Critics Circle. It was one of the nominees for that year.
When was this published?
It was published in 2010. Actually, pretty early in 2010, yeah, 2010, which is weird. And it was published straight to paperback, which was one of the things that kicked it up in my radar instantly. It's real nice. It's a great book that you even if you're not necessarily interested in the subject, I would still encourage you to check it out.
Yeah, I wasn't sure, you know, when they started it, but Greg said I would really enjoy it, and I did wind up enjoying it, and I read it very quickly.
I guess most importantly, it makes me want to read some Russian literature.
Yes.
I want to read that. I want to read even like other Russian stuff, like The Travels in Siberia by Ian Fraser, which had a really great excerpt in The New Yorker about basically him trying to drive across all of Russia, which is a lot harder than you think.
Russia's pretty big.
It's pretty big, and some of the roads in the middle, not so good.
Yeah.
Because nobody drives from one end of Russia to the other. Everyone takes the train or something. It's a pretty wild book that I want to check out sometime and read some Dostoevsky and some other stuff like that.
Kick out some Tolstoy.
Yeah, you know, just knock out.
Read a little War and Peace.
The history of Russian literature, you know. But actually she has a list of the books that she would recommend for Russian literature on, the Bookworm site. And we'll include a link to that. But it's just the list of ones that she would recommend from the Russian writers that she enjoys. So we'll pop that up. But yeah, in case you want to try it yourself. And also, if you're going to check out some of the bigger ones, like Dostoevsky, that kind of thing, I would recommend the Pevier and Volonsky translations. It's this husband-wife team that they've been sort of working their way through most of Russian literature. And they've translated.
Did we read an essay about them? Somebody wrote about them.
Yes, and David Remnick.
In his essays. Okay.
In translation.
Essays about essays about essays.
Yeah. So there's this other book called Reporting. That's David Remnick is the editor of The New Yorker. In addition to putting out probably, that's probably one of the tougher jobs in the world. Given that The New Yorker comes out every week.
Yeah.
It's like four times the load of putting out something like The Atlantic. And he has to he basically goes through and edits everything, and he has to do it every week, and he basically doesn't really get vacation time. But on top of all that, he also finds time to go off and write essays himself, like a few times a year.
Yes.
And
He's the one who wrote those wonderful essays about Solzhenitsyn, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he likes.
This is another writer that I really want to read. Another Russian writer that Batyumin discusses in her book a little bit, at least. You know, I think she talks about Cancer Ward, because when Solzhenitsyn had cancer, he was in Tashkent, Uzbekistan. Right? Am I remembering this correctly?
I don't know.
Yeah, that's where he was in the hospital, and So, and little things like that are sprinkled throughout her writing, little connections with other Russian writers or examples of their work. And it's hard to write about literature in an entertaining way. In the last essay, she's talking about demons, and she kind of recites the whole plot of the book, and it's a complicated book.
Yeah,
and it's hard to do that well.
And it's weird because she not only recites the plot of the book, but she sort of explores these are different ways that it could have happened and how it might have happened in earlier drafts and that kind of thing,
yeah.
And sort of bounces them off against each other. And so it's really interesting to make a comparison to another Errol Morris film like the Thin Blue Line, which you haven't seen, but that's one with a lot of counterfactuals and like what if, what could have happened and that kind of thing, and dramatic reenactment as such. But, Remnick actually came up in the Russian Bureau of the Washington Post, I think, was how he got started. He wrote Lenin's Tomb around the time that Soviet Union broke up, and that won a Pulitzer, and then he gravitated towards the New Yorker, became the editor, like, over 10 years ago, and has done it ever since. But he has a great book called Report, and that's just a bunch of essays. And it kind of gets grindy after a while just because it is a bunch of essays and there's a lot of them.
But they're very, very good.
They're very good. And he writes a lot about Russians. So another cool recommendation. But anyway, P. Baron Volonsky was a husband and wife translation team where he knows more English. She goes through and she produces a technically correct translation along with notes about the meanings of different things, and then he'll go through and make it sort of readily in English and give it across the sense of the tone that different parts of it are in. Because one of the interesting things that they talk about is that there are sections in their characters speak in very different ways, in sort of guttural ways and sort of high, sort of like the same way that there are different like British accents and that kind of thing. And other translations like Constance Garnett is the real infamous one where she would go through and she would skip words that she didn't know what they meant and ended up producing a translation that sounded all the same. It sounded all like Constance Garnett instead of each individual Russian author's style. And so they've done a real great job of sort of not just going back through and making it more technically correct translation, a more beautiful translation, but also reinvigorating interest in a lot of these older works, which is
I'm impressed you really remembered cool. that. I had forgotten.
I have a pretty good memory.
Well, you remembered their names, which is
well, I mean,
far more than I could have done. So I'm impressed.
Books. One of my weird little like hobbies is book googling. Like, it goes back from when I was I worked at a library at the library page for, like, a year when I was in high school.
Yeah.
And, I mean, my Amazon wish list is big enough that I had to make another Amazon wish list because I hit the limit, which is around 2,500 items, by the way.
Yeah.
So I have a wish list, and I have a new wish list that I've had to put books in ever since. So it's one of my bad habits, which is, by the way, I've never, like... I have more items in my Amazon wish list than I can possibly read in the rest of my life. If I'm reading about 50 books a year and...
Talk about resignation of the soul.
Yeah. So that's another 50 years of reading. And so that would put me about 75. So, and that's assuming that I maintain 50 books a year, which is not going to be the case. Like,
well, are they all books? Everything on your Amazon wish list is books?
Pretty much. I mean, there's some dumb shit there, but... It's all pretty much books. So, what was me?
What was I?
Whatever.
Grammar.
Oh my god, whom? yeah, it's Russian literature. We'll be back in a second, and we'll talk about the other books that we've been reading since. It has been a few weeks since we last put out a podcast, and... we read a few books in the time that it takes, because it takes us a while to sync up on a book that we like. So we'll bounce around between other books and sort of fulfill our own interests before we manage to line up. So we'll talk about some of those here in just a second.
Welcome back. We're still here. We're going to talk about some of the books that we've been reading lately. Garak, you've been reading with more variety than I have for once. I think you've been reading more in the last couple of weeks than I have.
That's because I read a book on the weekends. Goodreads is currently unavailable. Fuck you. That's cool. They have a nice little woodcut of somebody reading, though. And a quote at the bottom from Bertrand Russell.
Well, what have you started reading? What is it? Wittgenstein's Mistress?
Yeah, I sort of got halfway through. I don't know. We can talk about... I think what gets you to quit a book? Because I'm pretty much at the quitting point with Wittgenstein's Mistress.
That's a good question. What gets me to quit a book? Usually boredom is the only thing that will make me really just give up. I don't quit books very often, but there comes a point where I feel that my time could just be better spent with other books. Mm-hmm. And I usually just sort of quietly shelve it. And because I'm always ashamed when I can't finish a book, especially if it's a book that's been really highly praised, like 100 Years of Solitude.
Oh, whatever.
But I just couldn't get through it. I tried so hard and I just couldn't. But
tried so hard and you got so far.
Yeah, I did. But in the end, it never really mattered.
Didn't really matter.
Mm-mm.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Quote your Linkin Park correctly. Sorry. But, yeah, in short, in case you can't tell, I'm a little doped up on Benadryl for this podcast because the...
This is the Books and Benadryl podcast.
Yes, this is not Books and Beer Day, it's Books and Benadryl. Because the pollen count in Chicago is currently at dangerously high levels, and I have been experiencing the fallout from that for, like, 2 weeks now because we're having such an early summer. So
she's never had problems with allergies
before?
I've
never had problems with allergies before in my life, and for the last 2 weeks, I have been miserable, and Benadryl is the only thing that works for me, but when I take it, it gets me really drowsy and loopy, so I'm not quite my usual self tonight, as you might be able to tell.
You made it through the whole day without taking any naps, which is pretty good.
Yeah.
Unless you took a nap when I was not
paying
attention.
No, I didn't take any naps today.
Okay.
But anyway.
I could see you going to Starbucks and napping.
That's also probably part of the reason why I've read fewer books in the last 2 weeks than usual, because reading, if you're already drowsy, can be a very somnolent experience.
Or it can be amazing. I mean, take some Benadryl and read the Wind Up Bird Chronicle. I can guarantee you'd have a heck of an experience.
Well, what I have been reading, I've been rereading the Game of Thrones, or the Song of Ice and Fire books, which birthed the Game of Thrones series on HBO, and I read them all this summer on Kindle, and I really sort of raced through them, and I wanted to reread them, and I'm actually really enjoying them. It's nice once you've been through it, and you're not racing to find out what happens next. There's a little bit more time to observe Martin's tricks and the way he sort of foreshadows some things, and there actually is a way to tell what's going to happen, but you wouldn't know it reading it through the first time. And so I'm finding it a really enjoyable experience. And I'm also still reading Glenn Taylor's The Marrowbone Marble Company, which is an enjoyable novel, but I put it aside for the last few days to read this book, The Possessed, and I hope to go back to it. And after that, I'm going to try to conquer the light in August, I think.
Yeah, I don't think you will.
Thanks for that vote of confidence.
No, I mean, okay. The moment that I knew that you weren't going to read River of Shadows is whenever it migrated to your bedside table. Because you don't read the books on your bedside table. You don't. I mean, when are you going to do it?
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
you
a
did
good
at
point.
Some point whenever I didn't go to bed at like 9:30 at night. But now that I do, there's no time. Like, the light's already out.
It will move from the bedside table, Greg.
Yeah.
It'll take up a prominent place once again in my life.
Okay.
But probably not till after I finish the game. Because if I don't do that, the Game of Thrones will already be there and will be a much less...
You're like a child with candy.
Yeah, kind of like that. I kind of have to get rid of all the desserts in the house before I tackle the broccoli. So, sorry.
That's awful.
Shut up. What do you talk then? Fine.
Oh, God. You're also reading the books because we watched the TV series.
Yeah, and I was inspired to reread them.
You're inspired.
Why are you being so mean?
Because I can. That's fun to see your reaction. So,
so you're getting bored with Wittgenstein's Mistress.
Yeah. It's just a long monologue, and it's... I mean, you can sort of see how it sort of prefigures... Nicholson Baker in his sort of style, because I've read
The Anthologist,
which I also crapped out in the middle of.
And you were telling me I'd love that, and it was so funny, and then you never finished it.
It is. It's pretty funny. It's just, I didn't know you didn't finish it.
You recommended it.
I sort of recommended it when I was in the middle. I was like, wow, this is really funny. And then, like, after 120 pages, I'm like, fuck, I can't read any more about poetry. I'm going to die. And so, and I'm that's sort of the same thing about Wittgenstein and Mithras, because it is very, it's very circular, it's purposely that way, but it also just, all these things that I just don't care about, and, I mean, there's not really any forward movement necessarily in the novel. I'm sure there will be apparent by the end of it, but I wasn't seeing anything, and it's just, and I just, and part of it was just a bad life choice that I made to start that book at the same time that I started reading The Noonday Demon and Atlas of Depression. So, like, bouncing between a fiction book about a mad person and a nonfiction book about someone who's experiencing a depressive breakdown, and they're both describing it in the most visceral ways. And so, at the same time going through my own shit.
It was the night that you came padding out to stare at the bookshelves.
Yeah, because I was like,
something to read that wasn't depressing, but you couldn't come up with anything.
No, yeah, and I'm still sort of in that situation where I picked up Walter Benjamin. I don't even know why I picked him up. I think I picked him up because I remembered the quote from the Theses of History, some theses on history. So that's one of the essays. And I always liked that quote, but I'd never been able to get into Walter Benjamin proper. Partially because I would always crap out on the opening essay, which isn't actually by Walter Benjamin. It's by Hannah Arendt on Walter Benjamin. And she just drones on and on about all this dumb shit. But I sort of powered through it this time. And I got to Walter Benjamin, and he is really a fantastic writer. He's very quotable. And he does a lot of really great stuff as far as taking something, and he's able to write these short, almost poetic passages that are very evocative of what he's trying to get to, but it has an amazing imagery to it, and it sort of makes things that you may not necessarily even care about sort of a lot more real and permanent and sort of present. And it's very aphoristic writing, it's very quotable writing. There's a lot of statements that he'll just sort of pop out, and he'll say something about one thing, and he'll say something about another thing, and it's not really structured so much. I mean, there is a structure to it, but he likes to sort of do short little bursts of writing about stuff, and it's really great stuff. I really recommend it. It's sort of, it's the kind of writing that you have to kind of sit down and work your way through it, partially because it is translated from the original German, and so you've got the weird translationisms to it. And part of it is just because it's very... It's just enjoyable on a word level. So I'm digging the heck out of that. I'm trying to resist the urge to quote just all of it on Tumblr. and so that's sort of what I'm working my way through. But I got to find something else to... Like, because I don't like reading just one kind of... With that kind of book, I need something else to fall back onto. And I think I sort of, in desperation, started reading Airframe by Michael Crichton last night. Because I was like...
On your Kindle.
Fuck. I was like, I have to have some dumb book on my Kindle that I can read. And so I opened it, and I forgot that, like, it's some weird burst of, like almost nostalgia from high school.
It was probably after the night we watched Congo.
It might have been after the night we watched Congo. And I was like... I remember Airframe being like
I tried to get the Kindle version of Congo because I was like, I have to reread this because I read this when I was like 12.
But I was like, I actually remembered Airframe being a sort of interesting book about like airplanes and, you know, disaster investigation and that kind of thing. And so I was like, you know, I'll pick that up and I'll read it later. And it was sort of like, then I forgot about it. And sort of, I picked it up again. I was like, oh man, I forgot that I did this.
Oh, thank God. Michael Crichton.
Michael Crichton. Thank you for Airport Fiction. And so I started reading that, and it's about what you would expect.
I mean, it's Michael Crichton.
It's very businesslike. It's very not a ton of fluting around on the prose, and it's very much very low effort. I think I got through and I'm pretty sure I'll knock it out in less than 3 hours total.
Well, maybe we can do our next podcast about Michael Crichton's golden years.
I'd have to read more Michael Crichton. Because Airframe is sort of atypical. Like, usually it's like, we fucked with science, and now science is coming back to destroy us. type of stuff. But you can sort of start to see that he has some sort of... some subjects that he's more preachy on than others. Like, you can tell, like, where his sympathies lie in the book. And as far as what he thinks about the world, and it sort of comes across there. So you can sort of see, okay, this is sort of how he started becoming the weird guy who doesn't believe in global warming or thinks it's exaggerated.
The Michael Crichton worldview.
Yeah, how that came about. And it's sort of... It's very oddly self-centered and self... He thinks very highly of himself, which, I mean, to be fair, the man is the only person in the world who's ever had, like, a number one TV show, a number one movie, and number one book at the same time. So, which he pulled off when ER came out in, like...
94.
Yeah, like, 94. And there was, like... There. And he the had, like, a movie Michael and a book Crichton. At the same time. So, back when he was alive. what? It's, he's, I mean, he's,
I know, he's, I know.
He's not
oh
going to be
God.
Successful anymore because he's kind of dead.
Thank you for joining us tonight. This
oh,
has
I've,
been...
I've read other books. what else did I read? Oh, yeah, I read Jeff Dyer. The Human Condition.
Something. Maybe we shouldn't... I want to read that, and we might... talk okay. about it another time.
So. Okay. Well, it's a fun little collection of essays by a British dude. That's cool. Let me see. Is there anything else? Because I've been popping them up about once per weekend. Like, I just read a book a weekend. Basically, I usually just sit down on Saturday and do it because we don't have football on anymore, and it's incredibly depressing. Oh, the other thing I've read, it's River of Shadows by Rebecca Solnit.
I think you've mentioned that on every single yes. podcast we've done so far.
Gonna keep the flame alive, and that was the one that we were originally going to read.
I couldn't do it. I
because it
to...
migrated to your bedside table. And,
it did.
And you just didn't.
I will read. I mean, it was very interesting. I just, for whatever reason, I couldn't.
Didn't have enough.
I just
dwarves
was not in me this week.
Didn't have sex, dwarves, ice zombies.
I hate you.
Dragons.
I hate you so much.
Oh my God.
He's just staring at me like he's disappointed in me.
What do you think about that? How do you feel about that?
I think it's time for us to say goodbye. Until next time, we haven't decided what we're going to talk about next, what
we're
going
to
read together next. Oh my God, get over yourself.
Oh my God.
And we will at some point soon, and we'll be sure to put it up. Can we put it up on the website if we decide well enough in advance?
I don't really feel like it. Well, I don't. I mean, I don't know. I'll put it on Twitter or something.
Ever done.
I don't know. I mean, like, I don't know. I mean, I the books of your website is a very pure thing at the moment. It just
okay.
has episodes,
okay.
just has episode description. There's no cruft, anything like that. I don't think we don't even have a description of who we are. It just is like, here's the work. There's no what's it called? The part that surrounds the book. It might be Paris something.
I'm sure if I wasn't high on Benadryl, I'd know the answer.
It's not an upper. It's a downer.
Thanks.
Do you get high on things that are downers? We leave that as an exercise for the reader. I don't know. I'll put it on Twitter. In between the jokes about this
MCU.
Insane NFL offseason that we're having right now. Today's been just amazing under all definitions of it. I woke up and I found out that Trapped in the Closet was coming back this year. And then at around 11 o'clock this morning, 11:30 or so, news dropped at the same time, essentially, that not only was Tebow going to the Jets, but also Sean Payton. It was the head coach of the New Orleans Saints. Has been suspended for a year, so he's probably gonna get fired. I don't know. It's not unclear, but he's basically not gonna be in New Orleans for a year. And several other coaches are like their backup plan was to have this this other coach take over, and they thought it was just gonna be for a few games. So they're like, okay, we'll have this other guy take over. But it turns out that coach got suspended for 6 games as well. And so it might end up being the old St. Louis Rams coach who got picked up by the as some, you know, rigor coach. He might become the head coach of the New Orleans Saints. And then it turns out Tebow may not be going to the Jets after all. There's just a lot of drama going on. It's unfurling in the most hilarious fashion. So, yeah, today's been a pretty good day, I would say. And we're recording a podcast.
Good day for Greg.
It is a very good day for me. And I got to go on walks twice. I talked to people that weren't you. What?
No. That sounds so mean.
It's not mean. It's just I work from home and I don't really talk to... And even if it's like talking to the checker...
I can't believe you just said that.
What?
Oh, my God.
So that's Books of Beer. We'll see you next
time.
Thank
you for joining us. Are we ready to go?
I don't know. Are we?
Yeah.
I want to make some more red sounds.
Okay.
Oh my God, you have this pained look on your face.
I'm so tired.
Oh my God.
My God.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. You think we're ever going to become one of those couples that
probably.
I think we already are.
Yeah.
That just collapses in upon themselves.
Yeah.
The burnt out husk of a neutron star.
I was going to say, like a building with poor structural support.
And a plane wedged into the side of it.